Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. The focus of today's show is a topic most of us would rather not think about, the prospect of the Big One, otherwise known as a Cascadian Subduction Zone earthquake and subsequent tsunami, but also more mundane disasters, such as major windstorms and floods. My guests today are Clatsop County's two preeminent local disaster preparedness experts, Pat Corcoran and Tiffany Brown. Corcoran is a professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Science at Oregon State University. He works locally through the OSU Extension Office in Astoria. Since 2004, his focus has been life, safety, and coastal development in tsunami inundation zones. Brown is the Clatsop County Emergency Management Director. As such, she is responsible for conducting disaster preparedness, planning, and mitigation activities throughout the county, and she also runs the County Emergency Operations Center. She serves as Vice Chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Pat and Tiffany.
Thanks, Joan.
Great to be here.
I think I'd like to start with our recent legislative session and a House bill that passed that lifts a ban on constructing public buildings in the inundation zone, which, of course, in Clatsop County, being right along the ocean, is a big issue. Pat, do you have any feelings about that?
I do, and hopefully I can filter them and be productive. One thing that I heard Senator Johnson say that sticks with me a lot is to be able to disagree without being disagreeable. And I think that's important in these days in particular. What I can tell you about what happened with the bill was a bill that was, you know, presumably about some surface mining issues, but also had language in it about the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, DOGAMI. And during the session, the bill on surface mining included language that, like you said, repealed two important things. The only regulatory line or law in the state of Oregon. In 1996, a line was drawn in understanding what the tsunami threat was at the time. And the legislature had the geologists draw the map, where's that line? And they determined that it would be good policy to say that essential public facilities, schools, hospitals, police and fire, things like this, ought not be built waterward of that tsunami line. Now, the tsunami is more of a zone than a line, but the line was drawn and that policy was developed. And for since then, it has required public buildings that were going to be built in the area, hospitals, for example, to consult with the Department of Geology about what would that mean, what kind of things can we do to mitigate that hazard. That piece of the law was repealed, and so no longer does that line have any significance. No longer is there any prohibition on building essential services within that former zone. Where this seems to be moving towards without any conversation is towards an engineering standard, essentially saying you can build wherever you want these public buildings as long as you build them to a heroic standard, you know, like they build in Japan, that kind of a thing. I think that's very troubling, and we can talk more about that. But that's my general sense of the bill.
Okay. Tiffany, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, other than, as Patrick said, the bill came about as a bit of a surprise to a number of people, and that we're now having a lot of conversations about it. And I think conversations that we could have had in advance of it as well. One of the conversations is about implementing the engineering standards, and that's what's moving forward. Moving forward, I just hope we have more people at the table talking about it.
Well, I understand that this bill was passed kind of in the dark of night with few people present. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Looking back kind of on the fingerprints and track record, that was correct. There was a committee that was looking at just this question of this line. I was involved in conversations 2 years ago about trying to line up this regulatory line with the line that everybody else uses for this magnitude 9.0 event, kind of the large T-shirt size line with DOGAMI. And the idea was, since this regulatory line was built before the new science came in, should that not be the same as our magnitude 9 line that everybody else is using? And that was kind of the direction. There was a committee that was exploring that this spring. their input was not considered, and this bill was amended as such with only two people advocating for it. A number of legislators said that, you know, they didn't know what they were voting for. The margins were so lopsided that you would wonder, well, what's going on here? And I think what happened was people thought it was a surface mining bill and that they didn't dig very deep. So that was unfortunate. But that's just my understanding. There's a lot of mystery. I wish I knew more of the details. Maybe we can learn more as we go forward. But that's, I think, what the public sense is from the observing that.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that any public buildings constructed within that inundation zone need to be built with these so-called heroic engineering standards?
No, I guess, to be very clear.
Okay.
Currently, the law, the way I talk about it is it's a geographic prohibition. Don't put essential services in this area that is determined to be very vulnerable to a engineering standard. And that is very different. It has not happened yet. But I fear that we're backing ourselves into a standard that is flawed on many, many accounts that we can go into.
Well, let's talk about the subduction zone earthquake. I think it is something that most of us would rather put our head in the sand about. So how likely is it that we could be hit with a major earthquake in our lifetimes? And all of us are in our 50s or 60s. Who'd like to start with that one?
I'll give that one to Pat. He talks a lot about the probability in his presentations.
So what the science has determined is there's about a 1 in 3 chance in the next 50 years of getting a magnitude 8 or magnitude 9 subduction zone earthquake. Subduction zone earthquakes are only either 8 or 9. And so that's a 1 in 3 chance in the next 50 years. So 1 in 3 chance, say, in the lifetime of, you know, a child of ours, for example, it would be within their lifetime a 1 in 3 chance. Now, that does mean also that there's a 2 out of 3 chance that it won't happen. But the fact of the matter is we're 319 years into this earthquake cycle that has erupted as few as 238 years since the last one. Okay, so we're well within the realm where it wouldn't be surprising if we got one. Now, hopefully we get an 8, not a 9, because it's half as bad. I want to encourage people to take this seriously, but understand also that it's probably not going to be as bad as your imagination is taking you at this very moment. And so let's bring some oxygen in the room and look at a more realistic scenario.
Well, and talk about the differences between an 8 and 9. What would the damage look like for each?
Well, it is an order of magnitude worse, literally, to go from an 8 to a 9. And so an 8 is what Chile got in 2010. Google those images. Damage, not destruction. A 9 is what Japan got in 2011. Destruction widespread.
And we saw some of that debris coming to the West Coast. And how many thousands of people were killed?
In Japan, there was nearly 20,000 people killed. But I quickly note that in Japan, there were 200,000 people in the inundation zone at the time. So 90% of the people affected got out of the way. And so that's a great goal for us. And it really points to the upbeat part that populations on planet Earth live on subduction zones. And they have aligned their behavior with what they know is going to happen. We just haven't been around this block before since Western settlement, and we need to align our behavior with what we know is going to happen, but that's very difficult for human beings. That's why we need to do things like planning and other kind of things that, in a formal way, make us collectively think about these sort of scary things and not require it just to be an individual act.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what we do to prepare, particularly your office, Tiffany. Talk a little bit about the role it serves in our county in general regarding disaster preparedness.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm happy to primarily because it's so poorly understood. You put the word emergency in someone's title and it conjures up some visions of a job that really doesn't describe what I do on a day-to-day basis. The first thing I would say for starters, is that the entire responsibility for emergency management for the county falls on the Board of Commissioners. Within the cities, it falls on their elected officials, but more broadly, it falls on the county commissioners. Statutorily, they are required to have someone on staff to conduct that work, that preparedness, mitigation activities, and a response in the event that something happens. That's my position. So in my position with the county, I'm responsive. When we talk about emergency management, we talk about it in four phases: preparedness, mitigation, response, and recovery. And those are the four everything I do every day falls into one of those four categories. Primarily, preparedness and mitigation. That's what most of our time is spent on.
And what does that look like specifically? For example, preparedness, not just for a tsunami, earthquake, but for a major windstorm, which is not nearly so uncommon.
Right. Well, preparedness looks very similar for a lot of different hazards. As we find that people in encouraging preparedness for the Cascadia, some people are so overwhelmed, they shut down. And so it's much easier to shift to the next windstorm that leaves you without power for 5 days. It's something that people can relate to. And it's a lot of the same activities that we encourage for preparedness for bigger events. At the government level, at the city and the county level, a big part of preparedness is also planning, creating plans for the city and for the responders in that operational piece. So there's a citizen preparedness piece and there's an organizational preparedness piece.
Okay. Getting back to the major windstorm, 2007 windstorm, what was the office's response when that occurred?
Well, the responsibility of the office during a widespread event, and I should say that, you know, the first responders in our county are very good at what they do, and they are very good with working within their capabilities, and when they aren't, they have mutual aid agreements, and they work together. Our office really only comes into play when they've exceeded those resources, when they're not able to conduct themselves in a sufficient manner based on the resources and capabilities that they have. The county's primary responsibility in an event is to declare the disaster and begin communicating with the state. Once we become involved, it means that the citizens and the agencies in our county don't have enough resources and capability. And the channel for asking for those additional resources and capabilities is through the County Office of Emergency Management.
Okay. And when does the Federal Emergency Management Agency become involved?
At some point, if the event becomes big enough, it gets declared at a state level. I'll back up and say that these are all financial thresholds. So in Clatsop County, the financial threshold is actually very low. It's somewhere around $250,000. Once we hit that amount in damages, we're able to declare very easily. The state also has a threshold. They declare at the federal level, and then those resources are then made available at the federal level.
Okay. How did each of you become involved in emergency preparedness? Pat, I'll start with you.
I started with a background in regional economics and rural development with Oregon State University in 1987 and did a lot of programming in timber-dependent communities, which at that time were reeling from the forest issues and crisis. That evolved into then working with watershed restoration councils that emerged out of that crisis to try to come up with solutions using consensus decision making with a diverse group of stakeholders. And it was a challenge. And so with other colleagues was helping those organizations kind of work more effectively. In 2003, I had the opportunity to come to Astoria for a 3-year NOAA-funded coastal storms program. On the first year I was here in 2004, the Sumatran earthquake and Indonesian Ocean tsunamis happened, and our coastal hazards specialist retired. And so I rewrote my position description to stay here and focus on education about economic development in the tsunami hazard zone. And I've been here ever since.
Did you know so much about tsunamis at that time, or have you learned since
I grew up in Wisconsin. Madison, Wisconsin. What did I know about either earthquakes or tsunamis? So I didn't come here to inflict some smarts onto some poor population. I moved here with 2 degrees in geography and didn't have my head wrapped around what earthquakes and tsunamis were until, like most of the profession, until we saw it on TV in Indonesia and we're like, holy mackerel. And so in 2012, went to Japan and saw what happened. And most recently, Tiffany and I in 2017 went back with another group and saw what they're doing now. And there are cautionary tales and inspirational tales from both.
Oh, interesting. Tiffany, what about you? How did you get involved?
Well, you know, I was working for the county as the clerk of the board for Board of Commissioners. And it was around 2010 or 2011 when they moved emergency management from the sheriff's department to the county manager's office. And I'll be honest, at the time, I really didn't have a firm understanding of what the profession was about. But as I began to understand, it became clear that it was a place where all my seemingly random life experience came together in one place. I've worked as a legal assistant. I've been a community outreach educator for parents, but community outreach. I worked as a dispatcher when I was in college. And so it ended up being a job that I had a lot of relevant skill sets for.
Great. If you're just joining me, you're listening to a pre-recorded interview with local disaster preparedness experts Pat Corcoran and Tiffany Brown. They're speaking about preparing for the big one, as well as more quote-unquote mundane disasters, such as windstorms and floods. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria 91.9 and KTCB Tillamook 89.5. I'd like to return to talking about Cascadia, the subduction zone off our coast. I understand that until 2011 or 2012, when a New Yorker writer did a big article about what would happen in the event of a major earthquake here and resulting tsunami, most of the country were not aware of what we were facing, or even most people around here. Was that your experience, Pat? As far as, I mean, do you agree with that?
Yes. I have a little different angle. I spent a day with Catherine Schultz talking about
the author.
This. Yes. And I was very much reiterating the point that I mentioned before about, come on, let's not only focus on the worst possible scenario, which can be so disabling. Let's talk about the spectrum and the most likely event, which is something less. And she chose to go with the 2x4 to the forehead approach. But in retrospect, that must have been needed at the time. I mean, you know, I kind of knew about it, but if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. She followed up with an article shortly after our legislative session, highly critical of the goings-on. Yeah,
she did. She was not complimentary about the House bill that we were discussing earlier.
Correct.
Yes.
So I guess, you know, part of this gets, for me as a job, I have to look at the positive aspirational aspects of this. Because, look, the bottom line is if this happens tomorrow, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay here. This is a beautiful place. Like every other population on subduction zones across the planet, we'll adapt and we will do some things differently as we move forward. The invitation is to start doing those things now, to do today the things we know we're going to have to do after the next big one. For any development project in the inundation zone, I think a guiding question should be, how likely are we to do this after the next big one? How likely are we to eliminate the only regulatory line relating to essential buildings in the tsunami inundation zone after the next big one? I don't think very likely at all. How likely are we to sort of badger and harass our Department of Mineral Industries, you know, essential research on hazards after the next big one? I don't think very much. But I do think that communities will choose resilient approaches. And I've got several of them that I've put in kind of a phrase that I would just love to share with everybody. All right. So I stand for the possibility of coastal communities thriving on Cascadia to weather the earthquake, deal with the recovery, improve our lot, and survive. So I think communities will choose to avoid the most hazardous area, that thin strip of the tsunami inundation zone. It's not that big. We can avoid it.
How big is it?
Well, it depends where you are. It's bigger in Seaside than it is in Astoria. And so you have to know your local area, but still, in Astoria, it's like 2%, you know, of our land area. I mean, so there are different regions, but coast-wide, it is a very thin strip. I think we overestimate.
And I know there are some great maps on the County Emergency Management website of the inundation zone, if I'm correct.
Yes, they're also found on the Dagami, the maps that are for the public that you're referring to are if you're searching for them, are called inundation brochures.
Great.
Point your browser to Oregon Tsunami Clearinghouse. and look around for all kinds of great information on
it. Oh, good.
So communities will also choose to see the economy as a system of soft and hard functions, you know, people and structures. This isn't just about buildings. Communities will choose to treat hazard zones with respect and humility. Communities will choose to adopt codes into their planning ordinances that have the science of which has been vetted for years. Communities will choose to build a reputation as an innovative place for dealing with our reality. I want to go to communities that have their head wrapped around this, right? Communities will choose to understand the impact of subsidence. To build a tsunami-proof building is short thinking. When this happens at high tide, the water table will be 3 to 6 feet higher than it is now. I've stood in a tsunami-proof building in Japan that survived all of the disaster, but at high tide, water was coming over the doorstep.
So unusable. You'd drown.
Well, you wouldn't drown, but you sure wouldn't. You're not going to rehabit it.
Okay.
So these big, expensive buildings need to spend a lot of public dollars to take down and then haul away because they're not going to be building blocks for the future because of subsidence. Communities will choose to understand that. They'll also to choose that this is a condition to be managed. Cascadia, there's no box big enough to check and make this go away. This is something we will need to manage for our existence. We'll insist on abundant funding for agencies helping us deal with earthquake and tsunamis. We will choose to maximize communication about the hazard zones so that the private sector can make rational decisions about where residential neighborhoods and other kind of things go. Communities will choose to have a conversation about where is this fulcrum? The cry is about we need to balance economic development and life safety. Well, okay, so where's your balance point on that spectrum? We need to talk about that. We need to address this head on and with transparency. I think there's a lot of like, don't talk about this and it'll go away.
Human nature, unfortunately.
Exactly. So communities ultimately will begin doing today, as budgets and opportunities allow, the things that we're going to have to do after the fact. Now, this is hard. Human nature isn't kind of supporting us in this. So that's why public policies and broader structures need to help us do the right thing. And that's why something like the repeal of the regulatory line was so disappointing. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to lots of good ideas about what we can do now affirmatively in the future.
Are there any communities taking those steps?
Sure.
Well, speaking of 3309, we're seeing something happen in local communities to remedy that situation. We have one right here in Clatsop County. Gearhart is working with state DLCD to develop a tsunami layer for their community development. So they're saying, now Gearhart has a particular challenge. When Dagami created the new maps, Gearhart, under the maps that were created, didn't have a lot of high ground. And so they looked at the secondary locations. They literally didn't have, using that scale, a place for their residents to get in the... And back to Patrick's point, that the biggest thing is not the most likely thing to happen. They came up with an 80% solution. I applaud them for it. I'll tell you why. It's allowed them to move forward. If you're stuck with this wicked problem that you can't build in the tsunami inundation zone, yet you don't have anything but the tsunami inundation zone, and then you need to move forward. There's a community that is not going to be adversely impacted by 3309 because they've already taken steps to solve the problem for themselves.
Wow. Well, and Seaside voters voluntarily are taxing themselves $100 million to build their schools out of the inundation zone.
And Warrenton voters as well. And I applaud both of those efforts. So we are doing things, and sometimes, you know, you have to do things in spite, maybe, what broader forces are suggesting, and I think there's a lot of room for creativity, you know, locally to do that. I also want to circle around to buildings, because Gearhart's a great example. They've been looking to relocate their fire station, and again, this, you know, is the very good, the victim of the potentially perfect. We have to think this through. We haven't been through this before. We really have to imagine the scenarios. The conundrum with a fire station is if you put it up on the hill where it will be out of the inundation zone, it's too far to put out fires. And really, if the next one is so big that that's where the fire station has to be, that fire station will not be able to put out fires anyway. Okay? So there's kind of a sweet spot. Same with police stations. I mean, you don't put them so far away you can't use them when you need them. And if the scenario is so bad they had to be up by the water tower, well, they're not going to have any function anyway. So not having thought through that, we struggle a little bit. So I, too, applaud this notion of, look, you know, that whole golf course is dry in 80% of the scenarios. You know, it is reasonable for people to go there. There is no perfection, and there is risk to this, but we can manage that risk. And it's great to start doing that. And so the emergency management, planning, I mean, plans I find are kind of boring. But over time, they establish the groundwork and direction, you know, to help us do the right thing. And so I think we're making progress, one step forward, a couple steps back sometimes, but I'm optimistic.
Pat, correct me if I'm wrong with this number, but I thought I heard you say at a meeting we both attended earlier this week that 30% of development in the county is within the inundation zone?
I heard at a presentation the city manager from Newport cite some statistics coastwide and mentioned that Clatsop County essentially has the most land in the tsunami inundation zones that could be developed. So that's an extra caution for us. We haven't done it yet because it's been low and wet, you know, but with the housing pressures and other kind of things now, you know, we're just about ready to do that.
We are getting close to the end. I'd like to give each of you a minute to kind of hit on what you feel is the most important point. Tiffany, I'll start with you.
Well, it's funny. We didn't talk about it today, but we had a demonstration last month, the Navy Gray Star Shores with the hovercraft demonstration.
Oh, yes.
To show us how we would how we could expect to receive supplies. It was really more of a planning effort at the government level, and it resulted in an effort down the coast. But it was great. There were a lot of people there. But that event, every event, circles back to the importance of personal preparedness. Yes, there people are coming. Yes, we have plans in place. Yes, we have a relative idea of how things will go, but it won't be happening for a while. And so everything that we're doing at the government level is moving the ball down the field, but it all harkens back to the important part that everybody needs to be prepared and that we need to be working on it together.
Absolutely, Pat.
So I guess I'd just like to close, you know, optimistic overall, we're making progress, but I really see a big threat, and that is without public debate, this using an engineering standard in the tsunami inundation zone. Oregon, I've been to Japan. I've seen their engineering solution. That's their choice. They're a wealthy country on a small island. We cannot afford to build the structures that they have in Japan that are required for the system of safety to live behind, nor would we permit environmentally to do that. Oregon has to come up with our own approach, our own solution. The primary thing would be to continue to avoid the worst of the hazard zones like we've been doing, and do things smartly and nimbly and not depend on engineering solutions for that.
Well, great note to end on. We are out of time. I want to thank my guests, disaster preparedness experts Pat Corcoran and Tiffany Brown, for coming into the studio and explaining what all of us should be doing to prepare for both big and smaller catastrophes. Thank you, Pat and Tiffany.
Thank you for the opportunity, Joan.
Pleasure.
Corcoran is a professor in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Science at Oregon State University. He works locally through the OSU Extension Service Office in Astoria. Brown is the Clatsop County Emergency Management Director, responsible for conducting disaster preparedness, planning, and mitigation activities throughout the county. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. This show is brought to you in part by a grant from the Clatsop County Cultural Coalition. Perspectives was engineered today by Brian Bovenizer. The show can be heard on the stations of Coast Community Radio, 91.9 Astoria and 89.5 Tillamook. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.